Good morning. In fall 2009, the department announced in its regulatory agenda its intention to initiate rulemaking on the scope of employer consultant reporting. The purpose of this meeting is to receive comments related to this activity. This is a listening session for the department. The intention of the meeting is not for communication to achieve any kind of consensus. Following a brief introduction to the issues for which we are soliciting comments, the floor will be open to comments, and your comments will become part of the rulemaking. The department is making an audio recording of this meeting that will be available to the public on the OLMS website. Microphones are available at the front of the auditorium on either aisle, and commenters will be asked to state their name and the name of the organization represented. We ask that you be concise and yield the microphone when asked. Now, this employer consultant reporting requirement stems from Section 203 of the Labor Management Reporting and Disclosure Act. And under the Act, employers and consultants are required to report concerning agreements and arrangements they have to persuade employees concerning their collective bargaining rights, and also agreements and arrangements they have to supply the employer with information concerning the activities of employees or a labor organization in connection with a labor dispute involving the employer. These reports are required by the employer on Form LM-10, a report that is due within 90 days after the end of the employer's fiscal year. And the Form LM-20 is used by the consultant to report activities. This report is due within 30 days after the entering into the agreement or arrangement. There are exceptions to the reporting obligation. In Section 203C, reports would not be required concerning an employer consultant agreement where the consultant limits activities to either representing the employer in court or in an administrative proceeding or in an arbitration. If the consultant limits activities to engaging in collective bargaining or negotiations on behalf of the employer. And reports are also not required if the consultant activity is limited to giving the employer advice. This advice exception in Section 203C is the primary focus of the planned rulemaking. As currently applied by the department, persuader reporting is not required when the consultant has no direct contact with the employees or limits activities to providing the employer persuader advice or materials that the employer is has the right to accept or reject. The department considers this application of the advice exception to be overly broad and therefore requests some comments here regarding that planned rulemaking to narrow the exception. There is another area of the law concerning which we are inviting comments today, and that is LMRDA Section 203E. Section 203E provides that no regular officer, supervisor, or employee of an employer is required to file a report covering services rendered to the employer, and no employer is required to report concerning expenditures made to any regular officer, supervisor, or employee in compensation for service in such capacity. The department seeks comments on the application of this Section 203E reporting exception to reporting under sections LMRDA section 203A2 and section 203A3. Section 203A2 requires, under certain conditions, employers report payments to an employee to persuade other employees concerning their bargaining rights. And section 203A3 requires employers to report expenditures to interfere with, restrain, or coerce employees regarding their bargaining rights, or to obtain information about employees or labor organization in connection with a labor dispute. The department also seeks comments on whether electronic filing should be mandated for Form LM-10 and LM-20. It is an objective of the agency to encourage electronic filing. At present, it is mandated only for Form LM-2 reports that are filed by labor organizations. In addition to the items I've mentioned, the department also seeks comments on the layout of Forms LM-10 and LM-20, and on the level of reporting detail on those forms concerning persuader agreements. The department also seeks information on how the use of consultants by employers has affected labor management relations, and how information on persuader activity has changed since enactment of the LMRDA in 1959. And at this point, I would like to open the floor for any comments. The microphones are open.
Good morning. My name is Jim Kappas, and I'm representing the AFL-CIO. And basically, I'm going to just speak about the advice exception. We urge the department to return to its original interpretation of that exception, which it adopted immediately after the enactment of the LMRDA. The department's original interpretation was that reporting is required in any situation where it's impossible to separate advice from activity, which goes beyond advice. And what that meant concretely was that the preparation of materials for use in persuading employees with regard to the exercise of their rights was reportable, regardless of whether it was delivered by the consultant or the employer. That would include both drafting and revising of materials. The department changed that interpretation in 1962 without a very thorough consideration of the statute and came to its, what is the present interpretation, which is basically that anything delivered by the employer, the consultant's role is not reportable. In January 2001, the department returned to its original interpretation in what has been its fullest consideration of the statutory text and history in the surrounding circumstances. Shortly thereafter, that return to the initial interpretation was revoked with very little explanation, and we are in our current position. As I said, we would urge the department to return to its original interpretation for the reason stated basically in the January 2001 notice. As that notice demonstrates, the use of consultants increased dramatically during the 1970s, and maintained a very high level of usage by employers in opposing employee exercise of rights through the 1980s and 90s, which, as the Dunlop Commission found, had a very detrimental effect on labor relations. It made campaigns and contract disputes much more contentious than they needed to be. In returning to the original interpretation, we would just make two additional suggestions beyond what might have happened in January 2001. First of all, the January 2001 notice might be read to require reporting only of material initially drafted by consultants, but not material that was revised by consultants after having been initially drafted by the employer. If that was the intent, we suggest that that would permit too much evasion in reporting on consultant activities, and that the department should return to the full interpretation that it originally reached after the enactment of the act, so that both drafting and revising of materials is reportable. Also, we would suggest that the department may want to consider engaging in notice and comment rulemaking so that it can revise the forms and revise the CFR regulations so that the reporting community is fully informed of the new interpretation. We don't believe that the department is legally required to go through notice and comment rulemaking to announce its interpretation. It never has in the past. We merely suggest that that might be a way of revising the forms and the rules so that everybody knows exactly what is expected. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Michael Eastman. I'm Executive Director of Labor Policy at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. First, at the outset, I want to say we agree with the prior speaker that we would encourage the department to use notice and comment rulemaking in this process. I'm going to speak very briefly about the importance of employer free speech in organizing campaigns and then share our concerns with what the department may do in this rulemaking. The 1947 amendments to the National Labor Relations Act explicitly recognize employer free speech rights. Employers unquestionably have the right to communicate facts and opinions to employees as long as it's not done in a coercive manner. Many folks in the organized labor community have wanted to repeal this provision, and these efforts failed 30 years ago. I would say that the Employee Free Choice Act debate is a less direct way of doing that. Card check enshrined in law is one way of not giving an employer to respond during an organizing campaign. With the failure of these legislative options, many supporters are looking to the regulatory process to try to erode employer free speech rights. And we encourage the department to have a legitimate debate on the proper scope of the advice exception, but it must tread cautiously so it's not used as a tool by those wishing to erode employer free speech rights. Often overlooked in the debates over the advice exception is that anyone found to cross the line between advice and persuasion must disclose not only the persuader activity, but must disclose every client that received labor relations advice. For example, if I'm a partner in a law firm of 100 partners, one partner engages in persuader activity, I must now disclose all the names of the clients that I have done labor relations advice for, even if it's not persuader related. My clients may not appreciate the fact that their relationship has now been exposed, even though they never received persuader advice. For this reason, many large law firms have a practice of not doing persuader work at all, but instead of limiting their work to providing advice only. Narrowing the advice exception will make it more difficult for employers to obtain answers to basic legal questions regarding their rights and responsibilities, not only during an organizing campaign, but in every facet of labor relations. It is important to note the National Labor Relations Act and its interpretations are highly nuanced and near impossible for a layperson to understand without counsel. Further narrowing the exception will cause some employers to voluntarily gag themselves rather than exercising free speech as the law permits. We urge the department to tread cautiously as it considers its options, as employer free speech and attorney-client privilege are not trivial matters. I would also like to express our serious concern with possible changes to interpretations under Section 203E. The statute was designed to provide disclosure when employers engage third parties to interact and persuade employees, because employees may not otherwise know such individuals are agents of the employer. This is not true in the case of the employer's supervisors, managers, and officers. The practical difficulties of accounting and reporting under the so-called split income theory cannot be justified. We welcome the opportunity to provide more substantive comments should the department wish it at a later date. Thank you.
USA since the 1970s, as well as the study by Craig Mehta and Nick Theodore entitled Undermining the Right to Organize Employer Behavior During Union Representation Campaigns published by the University of Illinois in 2005. In conclusion, I'd just like to say that working people in the United States have a statutory right to know the identities of the people and firms who are getting paid to oppose their right to organize. Where there may be room for debate as to how often consultants advise employers to violate the National Labor Relations Act, their advice is invariably contrary to the spirit of that act. Accordingly, we need to bring their activities out of the shadows, and we encourage the office to do so. Thank you.
My name is John Rodabaugh. I'm a former member of the National Labor Relations Board, and I think it best that you allow for notice and comment rulemaking. I would advise it, and I recommend it. And I'll not respond now to comments that reflect a lack of understanding of labor history, labor law, labor economics. Thank you.
I'm Russ Brown with the Labor Relations Institute, and a practicing persuader. As far as the complying with the advice law, just want you to know that LRI sees no difference between advice and actual persuading. We report it all the same. We are extremely concerned that your proposals are overly broad of the scope and the spirit, that it's maybe easy to do measuring and reporting for law firms and consulting firms in these things. I think it's less easy and unpractical to put those limitations on supervisors of companies. You never know when a water cooler conversation is going to turn from a football game to talking about union activity. And at the end of the day, all employers are subject to ULPs under Section 7 and Section 8 of the NLRA. Therefore, you're looking to go beyond and an unpractical way of setting up entrapment of employers and turning this into a criminal application, which is wrong on several other levels. Really need to take a look at what is the real goal here. Are you just trying to take away the free speech of employers? That's the conclusion.
My name is Steve Bernstein. I'm with Fisher & Phillips. And well, I appreciate the comments that have been made thus far today. In our estimation, not enough of them go to the threat that a narrowing of the scope could have on the attorney-client privilege and the very real possibility that as the advice exception is narrowed, as some constituents for organized labor are advocating, so too will be a substantial encroachment on that privilege, a privilege that has stood the test of time for over 200 years in this country. And I would go on to say that some of the comments I've heard this morning go immediately from A to C by making the assumption that businesses, whether they engage a consultant or an attorney, are receiving services that are designed solely to undermine a campaign as opposed to steering them through the myriad of requirements that have only grown since the NLRA was first passed in 1935. And from that standpoint, I would argue that if, in fact, the advice exception is narrowed as substantially as some on behalf of labor are calling for. I would urge the DOL to consider the possibility that what it may do is discourage employers from engaging attorneys or consultants to provide them with the practical advice they need, but also the legal advice they need to steer clear of avoiding any legal infractions. And so in a way, narrowing the exception could essentially work at cross purposes with what we would assume both DOL and the National Labor Relations Board are interested in securing, and that is a playing field in which all parties, employer and labor alike, are operating with a clear understanding of their rights and obligations under the law.
Bridget O'Connor with the Bricklayers Union. I'd like to speak to the advice exception. I would urge the Department of Labor to narrow this exception. The practical effect of the exception now is that when a persuader, a consultant, speaks directly with an employer's employees so that the employees are aware of the involvement of the consultant, it's reportable. Where it's behind the scenes and the employer acts merely as the ventriloquist dummy passing on the message of the consultant or the lawyer, it's not reportable. And this seems to me, just on a common sense level, to be completely contrary to the purpose of the act, which is to allow employees, unions, and the public to know about and evaluate the activities of hired consultants in union organizing campaigns. To me, it's sort of equivalent to saying you have to report your income if it's made by payroll check with deductions, but if you're paid cash in the back room, it's not reportable. It's completely unintuitive. And just addressing for a moment the attorney client privilege issue, the statute clearly envisions a reporting of persuader activity. The fact of the attorney-client relationship is not in itself privileged. And when a lawyer crosses the line from persuader activities to actions, then that quite simply is reportable. And if other relationships are reflected because of that crossing of the line, that's simply a consequence of the statute. And the fact of the relationship is not something that the statute allows to remain hidden. It's not something the attorney-client privilege allows to remain hidden per se. And so I would just urge the department to take a look at the purpose of the statute, and I would argue that the advice exception has obscured that purpose, and basically the exception has swallowed the rule. Thank you.
Good morning, I'm Elizabeth Nadeau with the International Union of Operating Engineers. Two recent campaigns of the International Union of Operating Engineers Local 49 Minneapolis, Minnesota collectively illustrate the need both for greater enforcement of current reporting obligations of consultants and the needs to require the reporting of indirect persuader activity. During IUE Local 49's 2007 campaign seeking to represent a unit of about 30 Knife River employees, Timothy Ewald, an attorney with Leonard Street and Dennard, directly addressed the employees in mandatory meetings during work time and encouraged the employees to vote against the union in an upcoming election. The union prevailed in the election despite the lawyer-orchestrated effort to derail the union. However, the union was unable to obtain a contract and has since been decertified. The attorney clearly engaged in direct persuader activity and should have filed an LM report but failed to do so. His conduct illustrates the need for greater enforcement. In a 2009 campaign involving Great Western Metal Recycling, Richard Ross of Fredrickson and Byron coached Scott Helberg, Vice President of Operations, throughout captive audience meetings with small groups of employees, during which the employer encouraged the workers to vote against the union in the upcoming election. The meetings were held in April 2009, including one that was held a little more than 24 hours before an April 17, 2009 election. At these meetings, Ross was careful not to directly address the workers, but repeatedly conferred with Helberg in whispers. Helberg would then add or modify his prior statements. The employers believe that while Ross did not speak at the meeting, he was controlling the company message and was there to make sure Helberg did not go off script. Under the DOL's current interpretation of Section 203, it's unclear whether Ross would be required to report his activity. While the employer was clearly the attorney's mouthpiece at the meetings that Ross attended, Ross did not directly speak to the workers. If, as urged by the AFL-CIO, the DOL returns to its original interpretation of Section 203, Ross would be required to report his role in the employer's effort to persuade the employees to vote against the union. Despite the captive audience meetings and the dissemination of anti-union literature, Local 49, IUE, prevailed in the Great Western election 29-1. Unfortunately, in addition to creating disruption pre-election, Ross's orchestration of the campaign to oust the union continued post-election. Ross was the primary architect of the post-election tactics to avoid successful negotiation of a contract. As the employer's principal negotiator, Ross delayed responding to the union's initial information request and then delayed the start of negotiations for 14 weeks. Negotiations did not commence until August 2009, even though the results of the election were certified on April 24, 2009. The union filed charges against the employer and settled the delay in bargaining charge by agreeing to a 9-week extension of the certification year. More than 1 year after certification and approaching the end of the extended certification year, Ross is still offering lower wages than are currently being paid. The union's efforts to obtain a contract have been further undercut by the employer's discharge of four union supporters. The NLRB found merit to unfair labor practice charges filed on behalf of these terminated workers, and those charges were settled. The terms of the settlement are confidential. Under the DOL's present advice exemption, consultants are not required to report behind-the-scenes anti-union coaching and strategizing or the drafting of anti-union literature. Unions and the public, therefore, do not have access to information on the staggering costs charged by law firms and other consultants for such behind-the-scenes conduct. If the DOL requires law firms and other consultants to disclose the cost of such advice, employers would have the ability to compare the cost of offering benefits and raises to workers to the high fees that high-power law firms charge year after year to defeat union representations. Armed with this knowledge, some employers, particularly employers of smaller units, such as the 30-worker units involved in the Great Western and Knife River campaigns, may opt to reject union-busting strategies offered by consultants. Employers may decide to negotiate in good faith rather than to pay law firms that have a strong self-interest in collecting the fees they earn for union busting. The harder the law firms fight the unions, the more they earn. Thank you.
Are there any further comments at all from the group? Okay.
Good morning. I'm Keith Smith, Director of Employment and Labor Policy with the National Association of Manufacturers. Hope to just offer some very brief comments today. The NAM's official policy position cite that employers should have access to the free flow of information with their employees regarding issues of union representation. We're concerned with the impact of federal regulatory efforts to restrict employers' ability to communicate with their employees. We hope that any proposed rulemaking will not hinder the ability of employers, especially smaller-sized employers, from receiving the information necessary to remain compliant with the existing labor laws. Expanding the definition of persuader activity will have a chilling effect on employers' ability to seek legal counsel necessary to navigate an often complex system of labor laws and rights. Should the department continue rulemaking efforts on this issue, we look forward to the opportunity to provide more detailed comments.
Will there be any further comments? That being the case, I believe that we can conclude this meeting. I thank you very much on behalf of OLMS for participating and for attending to this important matter.